Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The state's high court last week ruled that Ohio's once largest charter school must show student login data to verify not just enrollment, but also participation to justify state funding. The Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow already closed earlier this year, but the ruling means that ECOT must repay the state $80 million. Plain Dealer reporter Patrick O'Donnell has been covering the issue. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Is this the end of ECOT, or was ECOT ended when it closed last winter?
So ECOT always had a chance of reopening if it won this case. ECOT closed by decision of its sponsor or authorizer, as other states call them, because it was not able to stay afloat while also paying back this money. If it had won its case at the Supreme Court and money would be returned to it and it would no longer have to pay, ECOT had a chance of reopening. Now its chances of it ever coming back alive are really very slim.
What is the effect on other online charter schools?
So that's a lot of that is still to be determined. So a couple other online schools have been held to the same funding standard that ECOT was, and there were small ones. They've dropped out of business. Others had to repay some money. The state is now in the process of figuring out how it wants to pay online schools going forward. The state legislature at the end of its session back in June had passed a law that included needing to start both a joint House and Senate committee to look at how these schools should be funded. We'll see what happens with that when recommendations are in later this year, and that'll be a big change for e-schools in the state.
Patrick O'Donnell, has this issue become much of a political football?
So it's become a pretty big one. The Democrats in the state are making it a very big one. For-profit charter schools in general, and ECOT specifically, there are a bunch of folks on the Democratic side who have been hammering away at Mike DeWine and Dave Yost for what they consider to be inaction about ECOT over the last several years and wanting them to be held accountable at the ballot box.
Had the state ever had any kind of oversight set up for these kinds of issues?
For this particular issue, mm-hmm. Not necessarily. I mean, there's been – Ohio in general has not had large oversight of charter schools and a lot of critical looks at charter schools over the years. Mm-hmm. We've been a state that has wanted to encourage lots of charter schools and school choice, so we've had fewer rules and fewer restrictions. And then when problems arise, we've stepped in to try and clamp down on them. So there was not a whole lot that was watching this over time.
There was a Legislative Office of Education Oversight that was closed in 2005. Would that have made any difference?
That's a really good question. That's something that we'll probably be taking a look at over time. I know some Democrats have been upset that was closed and say that if they might have been able to look at things a lot closer. You know, that's kind of an opinion, and we'll be looking at that more.
Bill Lager is the man behind the curtain when it comes to ECOT. What about his role in all of this?
So that's a lot of that still being spelled out. So as we know, Bill Lager is the founder of ECOT. He is also founder of two companies. IQ Innovations and Altair Learning Management that have done about $200 million worth of business with ECOT over the years. That relationship is at the center of attempts by Attorney General Mike DeWine right now to try and recover money from those companies. I think there's a lot that's going to have to still come out about exactly what role Mr. Lager had in ECOT at the time his other two companies were hired, and whether that constitutes a legal conflict of interest that would make those contracts void and make a lot of that money that went to those companies returnable to the state.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're devoting the hour to the issue of ECOT and for-profit online charter schools in Ohio. My guest right now, Patrick O'Donnell. He's a reporter for The Plain Dealer. He's been covering this issue. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So ECOT shut down last January, I believe.
Yes.
What of the, was how many students was it, 15,000 students? What of them? Where have they gone?
So, well, they had about 15,000 students at its peak. Then there's been a lot of controversy about ECOT over the last few years, and that number dwindled down to, I believe, around 11,000. When they closed, students had to go and find a lot of other schools. A lot of them went to other online schools in the state. That was familiar to them, so they went, boom, right into the other online schools. Some went to districts. At last count, there were about 2,300 kids who were unaccounted for. Those could have been homeschool kids who were enrolled in ECOT and just stayed with homeschooling. Mm-hmm. Those could have been kids that were on the verge of dropping out and just fully dropped out.
Have those other districts prepared? I mean, was this a burden for districts to take on these students kind of overnight like that, or were they prepared and able to do it?
So I all the districts I talked to said that they were welcoming them back and that they were not expecting to have to make big changes. I don't think any particular district got such a huge influx that it was a major change for them. I mean, it was a big change for a couple of the online schools. There's Ohio Virtual Academy, which is now the state's largest e-school, almost as big as ECOT was at its peak, that had to ramp up its business and add a lot of computers and connect a lot of kids. Connections Academy, the next largest e-school in the state, also had to add a bunch of kids. Those are the two that probably had the biggest influx and had to make the biggest changes.
Does the exit of ECOT leave a vacuum for other for-profit entities to move into Ohio?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think that Ohio Virtual Academy and Connections are going to try and fill that void.
Mm-hmm. What about Bill Lager's properties and stuff? You wrote about the state going after his Key West and Seneca Lake houses.
Yes. So Mike DeWine's last filing mentioned that, you know, he's bought a lot of properties and that they're looking at, you know, those properties could be seized or could be sold, and the money could go back towards, well, the money would go back to ECOT itself, which would then owe the money to the state. We're going to see how that plays out. We have, you know, Mr. Lager is going to be able to kind of have to try and claim that money that he bought those with was, you know, well earned. He could argue that there was other business that his companies did beyond just ECOT that makes that money legitimate. So that's a court battle that's still going to be fought, and it has not yet been determined.
You know, another side note that just occurred this week, I'm not sure if you've covered it, Patrick, so forgive me, but David Brennan of White Hat Management, David Brennan was one of the guys out front on developing charter schools in Ohio back in the 90s. He's thrown in his hat, so to speak.
So I've covered that a little bit. Mm-hmm. The Akron Beacon Journal did a really good story about him, a little overview on his history and what's happened to his once giant charter school empire.
Right.
I've picked up pieces of that. So he has been breaking off chunks, selling off pieces of his charter school network over the past few years. So some people that split off from White Hat have started their own companies. And those have picked up some of the schools. I most recently wrote about the Excel Charter School Network, founded by Ron Packard, who was the head of the founder and former president of K-12 Incorporated, which is the giant national online school company. They are the ones who run Ohio Virtual Academy. Mm-hmm. But he broke off from them a few years ago. He's picked up a bunch of the White Hat Network, including White Hat's online school, Odella.
What do you think, you know, as a journalist, that the future holds for these kinds of schools? I guess part of it is, as you said earlier, it just kind of depends on what lawmakers decide to do before the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't sense a lot. I mean, I have not heard a lot about people wanting to ban for-profit schools from the state. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of folks on the Democratic side who would want to do that. I have not heard a lot of that from Republicans. So there's researchers out at Stanford University, a group called Credo. They've done a lot of reports about online schools and charters across the country. They have not found any significant difference in the performance between for-profit charter school operators and nonprofit charter school operators. Whether people here have the stomach to throw the for-profit ones out was kind of hard to say.
Nora in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nora.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have a question and a comment. My question is, what was our State Department of Education doing for the 2 years that $80 million was given to ECOT? Don't they ever check? And my comment is, people say the state of Ohio doesn't support education, and yet in 2 years we gave $80 million to ECOT. And make sure people understand that's not property tax, that's state income tax money. Those are my comments.
Okay. Thanks, Nora. Patrick O'Donnell?
So I will say also first, ECOT received more than $80 million over those 2 years. They received a lot of money for all their students, and that's the money that the state found that ECOT was overpaid. ECOT was able to document class participation for a lot of its kids for a certain portion of time. This was extra. This was the portion they could not document. Was the state at fault for those years? That's an interesting question. Perhaps the bigger question is ECOT's been in operation since around 2000, and there are folks who believe that things like this have been occurring throughout the entire existence of ECOT. Mm-hmm. It was the last 2 years where the state started watching. Keep in mind, too, that we had a different superintendent until a couple years ago, and under former Superintendent Dick Ross, there was not a lot of attention paid or a lot of criticism made about charter schools while Dick Ross, a former John Kasich aide, was the superintendent. It was under his watch that David Hansen eliminated online schools' poor grades from reviews of the sponsors or authorizers of schools. So I think things have tightened up a lot under new state superintendent Paolo Di Maria.
Patrick O'Donnell, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your help.
Sure. Happy anytime.
Patrick O'Donnell, reporter for The Plain Dealer. He's been covering the issue of ECOT and what it owes the state in repayments for the lack of participation by students. ECOT has said that it wanted to count the enrollment, not the level of participation. The Ohio Supreme Court last week ruled that the state is right and legitimate in asking ECOT to verify actual participation. We'll be right back. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The state's high court last week ruled that Ohio's once largest charter school must show student login data to verify not just enrollment, but also participation to justify state funding. The Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow already closed earlier this year, but the ruling means that ECOT must also repay the state $80 million. We're talking about ECOT and the legacy it leaves behind this hour. Joining us right now is Vice President for Ohio Policy and Advocacy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. That's a policy think tank that also sponsors charter schools. Chad Aldis, welcome back, Chad.
Hi. Good to be with you.
How has the ECOT story affected the larger trajectory of charter schools in Ohio?
Yeah, I think it's been an ongoing story for charter advocates for the last couple of years. And, you know, as you're trying to talk about the benefits of charter schools and how they can really help kids, especially some of the national research that shows how big a difference a great charter school can make in the lives of low-income kids, we've got this proof point here that is anything but positive. So when the public and politicians and others look at ECOT and the situation here, it's certainly not been positive for the charter school sector.
It's been a huge distraction.
It has been. And, you know, and that's the biggest thing. I know there was some talk in the first segment about the politics of this and how it's a political football. And quite honestly, you know, the real danger there is we take so much time and effort, which politicians are apt to do, assessing blame or claiming credit, and we don't learn the lessons we need to about how we move forward, how we improve online education, what changes in law need to be made. And if we miss those big lessons from it, then you know, a bad situation will be even worse.
Talk to me about what the impact has been on other for-profit online schools in Ohio, because although the Supreme Court did clarify some things in its ruling last week, until it's set in law, it's kind of hard for them to follow.
Yeah, well, I think the one thing the court decision clarified to online charter schools in Ohio is, listen, we need to be documenting all of our students' participation time, you know, to the minute if we're going to get funding. Because the Supreme Court has now said the department's interpretation of the law is fine to move forward. So, you know, that's a shot over the bow if any online school is not doing it correctly. It's clear now beyond all doubt that that's what the law states. That's what's currently required.
And also brought more greater scrutiny on the effectiveness of online schools. They're not all created equal.
No, that's exactly right. And we've seen some of that, you know, throughout the last few years. Research has actually been growing nationally over the last few years. Earlier was mentioned Credo from Stanford University, a really high-level research organization. Back in November of 2015, they released a research report showing online schools all over the country, not just in Ohio, generally lagged with student learning. The learning losses for students in math, for instance, a student in an online school lost on average 179 days of learning in a 180-day school year. That's a big deal. And so Ohio is dealing with this issue and trying to work out the logistics of online education and how to make it serve students better. But Ohio isn't alone here. And that's one of the important things to remember. We were alone in ECOT in the way we're trying to figure out how to fund them properly, but not in terms of student achievement.
Joining us now by phone is Education Policy Fellow at Innovation Ohio, Stephen Dyer. Welcome back, Stephen.
Good to be with you, Ann.
You know, Chad Aldis mentioned earlier there's a big blame game going on. There's the political football of all of this. And in the process, maybe the state and lawmakers and politicians aren't really taking a step back and looking at what the big lessons are. What do you think about that?
Well, I think one of the big lessons is there are consequences to big political contributions to campaigns. To ignore that, I think, is to ignore one of the major issues that has caused a lot of problems with how Ohio has been able to implement charter schools over the last 20 years. I mean, yet last week it was amazing. On the same day you had the ECOT ruling came down, the Beacon Journal finally reported that David Brennan is finally out of the charter school game.
Right.
So you had, you know, two guys who, between the two of them, have given over $6-7 million to political campaigns, and in return, they've collected a lot of public money for not doing a very good job or for educating kids that weren't there. And, you know, one of the lessons is, are we going to let the people who let that happen get away with it? And so, you know, I think it's healthy to talk about that, because we need to have folks who understand that, you know, what we should be focusing on is, what do kids need? How do we properly fund school options? How do we make sure that the options are, in fact, better ones, not just more unsuccessful ones? And how do we make sure that the funding system that is in place to fund these options doesn't adversely impact the kids who are whose parents are not exercising those options? So, again, you know, to divorce you know, I know I more than anyone would love to divorce politics from this issue for many reasons, because, you know, it's been way too political in Ohio for way too long. But the fact is that, you know, the guy, you know, the ECOT thing has revealed that the guy who gave a lot of money to politicians over the last several years was probably operating a criminal enterprise under the guise of educating kids who weren't even there. So, you know, I think you got to talk about it. And, you know, when I first ran for office in 2006, I was telling all my friends I wanted to run to fix school funding and do all this kind of stuff. And I had a wise former reporter friend of mine who came up to me and said, you know, nobody ever won an election based on education. And I think that's kind of been the problem in Ohio, is nobody has really won an election based on a willingness to, you know, to provide equitable and adequate funding for kids. And nobody's really lost an election because they've done the opposite. So I think I've always said for a long time that, you know, if you're upset with how schools are funded, if you're upset with how this system is working for you, you got to start making it matter at the ballot box, because that's when the politicians and the policymakers really listen. So again, I do wish we were in a non-political world where we could just discuss, you know, the merits of this and how do we get the system going and all that. But I think what the ECOT situation really reflects is the intrusion of political money and power on the policymaking for education in Ohio.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from Stephen Dyer. He's an education policy fellow at Innovation Ohio. And also with us, Chad Aldis, Vice President for Ohio Policy and Advocacy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. That's a policy think tank that also sponsors charter schools. You know, Chad, you said that it's going to be hard to get to force out, and you don't see the climate changing for-profit schools. But the for-profit aspect of all of this leads to that issue of campaign finance and financing campaigns and donations to lawmakers. These companies have something to gain by it. They can profit from this. And furthermore, there's some states that actually ban for-profit charter schools to avoid these kinds of things when it comes to their educational system.
Yeah, a couple points on that. First off, technically speaking and legally speaking, charter schools themselves are all nonprofits, which is important for people to notice. But you're right that many charter schools, about 30% or so in Ohio, do contract with for-profit operators. Mm-hmm. Now, they may be a very small part of the operations, getting 10 or 20% of the funds, helping with some back office things, or it might be essentially turnkey operations where almost all of the dollars go to the for-profit
like
entity.
Like with ECOT.
With the online charter schools. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, but it is an important distinction to know. Well, you know, one of the things is, you know, we can talk about, well, nationally, as Patrick mentioned earlier, there isn't a difference in academic performance and student achievement with online, or excuse me, versus with for-profit versus not-for-profit operators, which makes it tough. There are some operators in Ohio that are for-profit that appear to be doing a pretty good job and educating students. So that itself, and honestly, we wouldn't be here having this discussion if ECOT had been hitting it out of the park. If they'd been serving kids really well, we'd be thinking, my goodness, how do we bottle
this? Which was kind of the dream of charters in the first place, yeah. Is they do something differently. They're outside the box. Maybe that's going to work, but it didn't.
Well, it's hard to say charter schools haven't worked. I think we can say ECOT did not work. I know charter schools, depending on in certain areas, even in Ohio, where we've had some uneven performance, they're outperforming traditional public schools. If you're a low-income African-American student in Cleveland, you gain an extra month of learning based on the most recent data in both math and reading by going to a charter school. And that's a big deal for a family, especially when kids are behind and they're trying to catch up. But you're right. The quality has been uneven. And I think the legislature the last few years, with help of advocates like Steve and others on the charter advocates as well, saying, look, we need to fix this because kids deserve a great opportunity.
OK, so what you said, what are the lessons? You said lessons learned. What are the what's the big lesson for you?
Well, you know, the big lesson for the e-school, the ECOT case is I think Ohio has some work in front of it to figure out what the proper way is to fund charter schools, online charter schools.
Why is that a mystery. Is there a template out there?
You know, there are a few states that are experimenting with competency-based funding, you know, paying for either a course completion or passing a test or a grade in a course before they give funding. But most are funding based upon enrollment, you know, which Ohio had previously done. I think as the last couple of years, as Ohio has sort of lifted the hood and looked on what was going on underneath in terms of tracking time, all of a sudden, I think that raised shined a light on the fact that maybe this isn't working out like some people had hoped.
You agree, Stephen Dyer?
Yeah, I mean, we could go down some nerdy rabbit holes right here talking about how, you know, the per pupil funding system versus, you know, some other kind of system to deal with fixed costs and those kinds of things. But I do think what the ECOC case demonstrates is just how fraught the current system is for, frankly, corruption. And, you know, my concern with competency-based is, you know, if you start basing funding on test scores, you know, you're just begging people to cheat.
An issue in ordinary schools.
Sure. And, you know, any time you add stakes to a test, you're just, you know, the examples are legion about, you know, examples of folks cheating on those things. Mm-hmm. So there are issues with however we fund them. I think, you know, the main concern I have is, you know, if we want charter schools, that's great. You know, have at it. My concern has always been not so much the amount of funding per se. I mean, you know, we could always argue about what the amount is. My concern has always been the effect that funding in charters has had on funding in local school districts.
How so?
Because the charters can't collect local revenue, charters generally get more state revenue per pupil than the kid would have gotten in the school district. So, you know, a kid in Columbus, you know, these aren't the numbers, but I'm just doing round figures so we don't have to do crazy math. But, you know, if the kid in Columbus goes to a charter school, they might get $10,000 to go to the charter school, but they'd only get $5,000 in state money if they'd stayed in the district, because the district can raise local revenue. So again, there's more state money flowing out. And so local taxpayers have to subsidize, those state funding loss to a charter school. And in some cases like Columbus, it's staggering. Over the last 6 years in Columbus, which lost $62 million to ECOT, local taxpayers have had to subsidize that loss to ECOT by $25 million. So again, it's a major problem, this current transfer system that we've got. You know, my thought has always been, you know, the states basically, charter schools are state animals. They're state funding animals. They're created by the state. So, you know, there should be like a pot of money for charter schools, and a pot of money for school districts. But that's also going to involve some issues with, whether, you know, with, per pupil funding. Because if those kids are no longer counted in local districts, then local districts will get less revenue. These things are all, you know, complicated and fraught with issues. But, you know, having that discussion is an important discussion to have. And it's going to be, I think, much more healthy in the future to not have major for-profit charter operators giving, you know, bags of cash to politicians to get in the way. And I look forward to having that discussion with Chad and others.
You know, are you suggesting, Stephen, that there be a ban on campaign contributions from charter school entities?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, you know, that two of the largest contributors to political campaigns over the last 10 years have stopped giving money. And by the way, I don't think it's any coincidence. I don't believe it's a mistake that suddenly the guys who were getting a lot of money from them started going after them after the campaign money dried up. But, you know, I think that, you know, getting beyond this, you know, really sad era of of you know, big for-profit charter operators giving a bunch of money to politicians, getting beyond that and starting to really talk about the policy and how to best implement, you know, effective funding schemes and accountability measures and all that kind of thing, without that, you know, that thing corrupting the whole process, I think that's going to be healthy for Ohio. And I hope that, you know, we can move beyond the Wild Wild West reputation that we've unfortunately well earned over the last 20 years.
Before we take a quick break, Chad Aldis, do you have any thoughts about the Legislative Office of Education Oversight? It closed after 15 years in business in 2005. What difference it might have made if there had been some kind of, inspector general type of operation overseeing these kinds of operations?
Yeah, I feel like an Ohio veteran, but I've only been here 10 years. So mm-hmm. It closed before I had even arrived. And
right.
I've seen some of the stories and some of the commentary about it. The one challenge I'd have is legislative entities, no matter how independent they are, end up getting their funding from the legislature. So, you know, the idea that this would have been a cure-all or something that would have really prevented it, at the end of the day, I'm a little cynical about that. I think that what happened with ECOT was something that maybe there was rumor around about how much students and anecdotes about how much students were or weren't participating. But all the schools, and at least given the number of schools that have had repayments, including some operated by school districts, have had a misconception about how they were supposed to be tracking funds and dollars. We've had a seismic shift in the way we're tracking student funding in online schools. So I'm not sure that unless that shift would have somehow happened sooner, we'd be where we are right now talking about how best to fund online students, what participation really looks like. And it's less compelling to me that this would have made a difference. It's always good to have oversight bodies. You know, Fordham's a nonprofit that tries to provide that and does a lot of reports and, you know, and will shine a light on things that are both good and bad. But it's hard when it's not impossible, but it's hard when it's a government entity doing so.
And Stephen Dyer?
Yeah, I mean, I think the LOEO did amazing work over the 15 years of its existence. And frankly, it was zeroed out at the last minute by John Husted when he was the Speaker of the House, because they started saying, you know, charters in Ohio aren't working quite right. We should start looking at it. And, you know, there was, after they went away, there was a dearth of, you know, there was, you know, folks like me and folks like Chad on, you know, on either side of the issue pointing out things, but there wasn't that, you know, that kind of, nonpartisan government entity, kind of like the GAO, you know, at the congressional level, calling balls and strikes on things. And so I think it would have helped. Would it have cured everything?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
But they might have, you know, they were at the time bringing light to the problems in the charter sector within 5 years of it being operated, and pointing out some really serious issues, like, you know, how some charters didn't have bathrooms, they didn't have books, there were a lot of issues that LOEO helped talk about. So I do think it would have been helpful to have a specific office to just look at education. It's the only thing that the General Assembly is required to do under the Constitution, is to fund schools. It certainly would have made a huge difference, I think, in developing the reality and lessening the political nature of the whole thing.
We are going to continue our conversation. That's Stephen Dyer. He's Education Policy Fellow at Innovation Ohio. Also with us, Chad Aldis, Vice President for Ohio Policy and Advocacy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. That's a policy think tank that also sponsors charter schools. So stay with us. Bring your questions, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The state's high court last week ruled that Ohio's once largest charter school must show student login data to verify not just enrollment, but also participation to justify state funding. The Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow already closed earlier this year, but the ruling means that ECOT must repay the state $80 million. We're talking about ECOT and its legacy. Still with us by phone, Education Policy Fellow at Innovation Ohio, Stephen Dyer. Also, Vice President for Ohio Policy and Advocacy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a policy think tank that also sponsors charter schools, Chad Aldous. Joining us is Professor of Educational Studies and Director of the College of Education and Human Ecology's Research Laboratory for Digital Learning at Ohio State, Dr. Quay Shea. Welcome to the show, Dr. Quay. Dr. Shea.
Thank you for having me.
What do you know about how digital learning works that would be an issue in the role of charter schools?
Well, I think digital learning has been proven to serve for a particular population of students. I mean, it has a lot of advantages. And for this particular case, I really think the schools in general needs to build a better infrastructure for assessing students' learning and engagement. Because in the research field, we actually think learning engagement is much more complex phenomena than just a logins and logouts, and it involves behavioral engagement that students log in and log out and then sitting there. But then they also can have cognitive engagement, because when a student sit there, if they don't engage cognitively, it doesn't mean they learn. And then there's a lot of different dimensions, like they have emotional engagement as well as social engagement in schools. So I really think we need to have a better understanding about students' engagement, especially in EE schools. And actually, there's a lot of research evidence showing all this type of engagement leads to student success in performance-related outcomes.
What do you mean by serving a particular population? What do we know about what kind of population e-schools are best fit for?
Well, e-schools and in general online learning, they have particular affordances, we call. So, for example, that they are flexible in terms of time. They are somehow adaptive or more personalized learning experiences. So for kids that have challenges at school, and for kids that have can't really go to the normal school attend, and then they might be more appropriate to be in those e-schools, that they can have better, I mean, when they have better family support, when they have parents that they can be more homeschooling, maybe that's a population they can serve for.
Hmm. Chad Aldous, what about regulations that dictate who is fit for an online school?
You know, that's being debated at the national level. In Ohio, was actually proposed in legislation that didn't end up making it through the bill that was passed this spring to increase regulations on online schools. There was a provision that said that if an online student was not actively participating, that the school would be able to disenroll that student, which is the first time we've had this. And it creates a bit of a debate. But at the end of the day, if we're looking at student learning being the ultimate goal, if an online school knows a student is not engaging, is not learning, is not doing their homework, then I think we maybe need to be able to give them the ability to notify the local school district and let them know this student, you know, they enrolled, we gave them an opportunity, so everyone has an opportunity to learn, but it's just not working for that student.
And Stephen Dyer, what about that kind of a regulation like that?
Yeah, again, the issue is that if we want schools to be public schools, every public school, the very definition of a public school is you take whoever walks in the door and you do what you can with them. I've always been kind of hesitant to say, well, only certain types of kids should go to certain types of schools, because that's kind of not what public education is supposed to be.
Well, I mean, if you're in special education, though, Stephen, I mean, it's been going on since 1979, I think.
Sure, but you know, when a special ed kid goes to Columbus, Columbus has to open the door and educate the kid. They don't get to say, "Well, we don't have the resources; go somewhere else." It's a It's definitely a challenge. I do agree that, you know, online education works for some kids. You know, my wife teaches online courses at Kent State University, mm-hmm. and it works really well for some of those kids, but they're high-performing nursing students. I think it can work for some kids. I do think having a good dialogue with a local school district is an excellent step. You know, where the school district talks to the online school and says, you know, we have a kid here who might actually be a good candidate for you, and work together and be, you know, be more cooperative and collaborative with each other. I think that'd be extremely healthy. You know, but in Ohio, we just haven't had that because of various reasons, not the least of which is political. So, you know, I think that having more of those exchanges and dialogues and cooperative and collaborative agreements between charters and school districts is incredibly healthy, because I think that, you know, in some instances, an online school would offer a better option. But, you know, there's just not much collaboration right now because of these lingering issues from the last 20 years. But I'm hesitant to say, you know, e-schools, yeah, you can kind of select who you want to come to your school, because that's not what public education is. That's private education.
Dr. Shea, I wanted to go back to something you said about building a better infrastructure. What do you mean by building a better infrastructure when it comes to digital learning?
For this case, ECOD, they're tracking student participation in the online system. Mm-hmm. But what I was talking about is students' learning is more than just logins and logouts.
Okay.
And student participation, the behavioral engagement really doesn't tell the whole story of student learning. So there needs to be a way to measure student learning in a more comprehensive way. And then we also need to find a way to identify malleable factors that can influence students' learning. And then if you don't have the data, then the schools, you can't make decisions or interventions to change students' engagement.
We have a listener now. She also happens to be the former executive director of the Legislative Office of Education Oversight, which closed shop in 2005, as we've spoken about earlier. It's Nancy. Is it Zajano?
Yes. Hello.
Hi. You're on the air. Okay. Yep. We just lost that call. We see if she can call us back and take that call. But in the meantime, the learning engagement is more complicated than logging in and logging out. I was worried about that when my child was taking a course in high school and part of it was online, Chad Aldis. I was concerned about that. But then I thought, actually, he really enjoyed it because they could get sort of the busy work and the prep work out of the way and had to show their work because it was online. It wasn't just you could say you did the reading at home. And then he went into class and they were prepared to have the discussions in class and it worked out really well. What about that kind of the word is escaping me, but then that combo type of learning?
Yeah. And many times that's referred to as hybrid.
Hybrid.
The ability to combine online education with a classroom experience is great. And some schools already in Ohio are taking advantage of that. But, you know, it goes to what Dr. Shea said as well. You know, the ability of online education to allow flexibility and personalization is exactly why it holds so much potential for the future. And it's why we need to figure out and work our way through these very painful growing pains and figure out how to do it right.
Why did it have to be so painful for Ohio?
You know, it didn't have to. Clearly, as Steve has mentioned, politics plays a role. But as I said, it's not just painful for Ohio. The data shows every state has struggled with this. Online learning is fundamentally different in some respects because of the ability for a teacher to directly interact with a student.
Mm-hmm.
When they're highly motivated, it's really easy. When a student needs additional supports, it becomes more difficult. And we're still having, as a nation, growing pains on this. Ohio, because we had so many online schools, the problem is it's even more paramount that we address it because it's bigger here.
You know, and Dr. Shea, I hear you. I mean, there needs to be more research done on these factors that go into learning. What do you think is a top priority at this point?
Right. I mean, I think the first thing we need to do is really to build a better infrastructure to get the data about students' engagement. And for the past several years, my team has worked with several schools in, I mean, not e-schools, but traditional K-12 schools in collecting students' engagement data, as well as those malleable variables, such as their interest, the value, self-efficacy, school belongingness, mindset, and a set of variables we think that can influence engagement. And then we work with those schools and then collecting the data, analyze the data, interpret the data, and then we loop the finding back to those schools and then to make policy changes. I think that's a healthy cycle for the schools to really get understanding about their students, the students' engagement, the malleable factors of students' engagement, and then eventually leads to improved outcomes. So we really think that when we design for courses or for learning experiences, especially in online schools, we shouldn't really focus only on the performance, which are the grades and GPAs. We really should think about how do we design for better engagement. We really also think about how do we motivate students to be engaged. So there's a lot of things that we should consider versus a lot of designs or a lot of policies are geared towards performance only. So that's what we have been working. And actually, Chad and I have been talked about how to study for the e-schools, and then we really wanted to have more research in this area, for example, to investigate the personal contextual factors that influence students' engagement in e-schools, and then how do we design interventions to prove students' engagement in those e-schools. I do think there's more research needs to be done in those things, but first thing first, we need to build a better infrastructure to assess students' learning and engagement in a more comprehensive way.
And Stephen Dyer, you think that the Ohio General Assembly is prepared to have these sorts of discussions at this point in time?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, our kids need us to have these discussions. I mean, it's, you know, whether kids are engaged or whether they are participating is, you know, an age-old question. And it's a lot easier to tell in a school where you've got, you know, a classroom. So the teacher can see, you know, this kid's engaging, this kid is not. In the online sector, it's a lot more difficult. You know, one of the real issues that we've had in Ohio that has kind of led to a lot of the scandals in the online sector is we frankly just pay online schools way more than other states do. You know, at one point, K-12 Inc., which was the largest operator of online schools in the entire country, mm-hmm. had about 10% of their income just come from Ohio taxpayers because we pay them so much more than what other states paid. So I think actually coming up with a system that more accurately reflects the cost of educating kids in an online setting is, I think, the key to the whole thing. Because if there's, you know, when we first looked at this in 2011, we were able to determine that online schools like ECOC could provide 15-to-1 student-teacher ratios, $2,000 laptops to every kid, and still clear 40%. So anytime you can reduce that and make sure it's the kids learning, not the adults making money, that matters, then I think you're in a good spot.
So there's theory, there's technology, and there's incentives. Stephen Dyer, Education yeah. Policy Fellow at Innovation Ohio, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Chad Aldis of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And Dr. Kwe Shea, Professor of Educational Studies and the College of Education and Human Ecology's Research Laboratory at OSU, thanks for your time. Thanks for
listening.
Thank you very much. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.